This is Dennis Goldring, recorded at his home in Gisborough, Teesside, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 23rd of May, 2010. Dennis Goldring, Part 1.
Dennis Goldring. I was born on the 30th of June, 1932, and my place of birth is Brentford, Middlesex, 77 at the moment.
What did your father do?
He was an engineer, a ventilation engineer. He died very soon after I was born, actually, virtually in that a day or two after I was born.
So that must have shaped your childhood somewhat?
Oh, yes, it did. Mm. Yeah, very much. Obviously, my brother and myself were brought up. My brother was 4 years older than me, and brought up, by my mother. Obviously, we never knew our father.
So, what kind of schooling did you have, Dennis?
Well, we went to a dame's. My mother moved. This was Brentford, Middlesex. West London, In 1934, she moved down to North Devon and made her home there, operating as a small guest house. We went to effectively what was a dame's school for a few years, and then we went to a place called the Royal Commercial Travellers School. For some reason, my father what was really an engineer, but he must have been involved in the sales side of Keith Blackman and Company, and somehow or other they got us for this free schooling at the Royal Commercial Travellers School, which is where we were educated until we were 18. Then went to Bristol University took my brother. Went to Bristol in 1950, I suppose. 49. He did his national service. I followed him there for one year behind. He started doing a course in geography, changed to geology. I was already interested in geology. So I chose to go to Bristol as well, took our degrees. We then both did PhDs at Bristol. Those were the balmy days, We were so lucky.
How do you mean?
Well, in terms of things like grants, for instance, my brother would have had a government grant for having done his national service. I had a Devon County Council grant. The grant paid tuition fees and our our living costs 100%. Think of people now having to cough up and having heavy debts around their ears for years. Was that early 50s was when the start of a really golden age of sort of university education, I reckon, and it gradually fallen away to the present state where far more people go to university. Mm-hmm. But there's, I think, saddled with debt, and a lot of them are not really getting jobs which are anywhere near what they're educated for. Mm-hmm. The poor girl who's doing this alum work did on a pretty bit poor salary compared with what she should be in the equivalent time back in the 50s.
What drew you into geology? What was your interest, or how was your interest engendered?
Oh, I was always interested in geography, so it was we thought that it was a related subject, I would guess. That would be probably how it got there. My brother got there slightly differently because of He was also interested in geography. He was going to be a geography teacher, but decided that the geology department was a much better and smarter department. So he, after 1 year, he actually moved course, which is another thing which people don't seem to be able to do now, incidentally.
So was geology something of a passion or just a...
Oh, well, it became a passion very quickly, yes. By the time we were taking our BSCs, we were certainly well established as wanting to be geologists.
What, can you think why you were so passionate about it? It seems such a... I mean, this is a very historic subject, isn't it? So, obviously.
Oh, we got... It's just the interest in it. Also, living in North Devon was a suitable place where there was an awful lot that needed to be done, you know, in terms of research and so on. So I would say that, you know, you gradually acquired this. Obviously, when I went up to university, I wouldn't have been so in. But even then, my brother had got interested. We were mucking about on the beach at Westward Ho doing some field work, and that seemed to take over. We needed to get that done. The net result was I never, for instance, attended the Freshers' Week. That sort of thing, you know, it's already taken over our lives, really. So, anyway, no problem with that. Been with us ever since. Well, not with my brother. My brother unfortunately died 4 years ago, which is rather sad. But that's by the by.
So was it the investigative side of it that fascinated you, or just dealing with something that's so ancient?
Oh, it's the investigative, it's the research side. We could easily have gone into some other subject, geography or history, for instance. We wouldn't have. I would never have been so good in physics, for instance, or chemistry, because of the need for having good mathematics. Geology didn't need very much in the way of mathematics in those days. It probably does now, but one gradually acquires these things.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic? How did you first become aware of it?
Well, as I say, I got my BSc in 1953. The prof had lined me up to do research already by then. In those days, you could carry on at the same university. In fact, it was a normal practice. Mm. So for the next 3 years, I was doing a PhD on structural petrology field work up in northeast Antrim, and a lot of laboratory work at Bristol. Come towards the end of that, I'm still 24, looking around for a job, but expecting, of course, to do national service. Mm. The prof, again in those days, you know, I was talking about this golden age. The prof regarded as part of his job to get you a job. Think of that. Mm-hmm. he casts around. He doesn't, you know, he works out what he thinks you will be good at. and offers you something. He'll only offer you one or two chances. He's not going to go around, but he is going to find you something. Sir Raymond Priestley comes round, who was with Scott, of course. very old man by then, that time. Well, I don't know. Probably younger than I am now, I don't know. Anyway, he seems old. Recruiting for FIDS. Sees the prof. The prof then looks through his list of his students and, oh, Dennis Goldring. He might be interested. I think, you know, I think he would be suitable. So I then have a short chat with Sir Raymond Priestley. I'm not particularly interested myself. Sounds too much like Scotch.
You mean too dangerous, you mean?
Yes. well, not dangerous so much as rough.
Yeah.
Living on in being cold, this sort of thing, not having enough to eat, blah blah. But anyway, net result is they FID send me the papers, application papers. I fill them in, not expecting to get any sort of job, because I hadn't done much in the way of sports at university, not a lot. I'd certainly not done any mountaineering. I'd not even done a lot of field geology. although we had been away in the summer up in Northern Ireland for a couple of months, which I suppose is fair comment. But anyway, I make an application, call for interview. I've been interviewed by one or two other. For instance, I thought I might like to go in the British Geological Survey or the Colonial Geological Survey, but they were at that stage they were only taking people. If they'd accepted me, I would have still have had to have done the National Service first. So from their point of view, having to wait 2 years in order to recruit somebody, it's obviously something of a bit of a dead loss if other people are more available to them. So anyway, but the FIDS, had an interview with FIDS, pretty poor sort of interview. There was a very clever fellow next, also being interviewed next to me, who was very glib. He had tremendous mountaineering experience, done a lot of field work, etc., etc.
Do you recall his name?
No. I don't want to, but I don't know it anyway. But this fellow, he then proudly said that he was communist, and he didn't get any job.
so you were interviewed not just solely, singly. You were interviewed
with
pairs?
A group. Yes,
a group.
Oh yeah, there were about three or four of us.
Were there single interviews as well, or was it?
The interview wasn't a group. We were waiting. We were waiting outside in the waiting room, and then interviewed singly. But he'd very cleverly, made sure that they knew he was communist. I don't know why, but that was a passport to not having a job, in fact, in those days. But anyway, I had an interview. I don't know who interviewed me, but certainly Ray Adie was one of the people. Would have been civil service gutwallers, I imagine. I was then taken into another small office where I had the real interview.
Oh, yes. Go on.
Johnny Green. He says, can you cook? Oh, yeah, I can cook. The dogs are very fierce, What do you like with dogs? Oh, I'm scared stiff of dogs. okay, he says, we'll inform you. In the usual sort of way, but you might as well go along and have your medical today. Now, I wasn't expecting to pass the medical.
was there a reason for that, then?
Yes, on the beach at Westward Ho, doing this field work, we've done a lot of augering, and this is
twisting movements,
and I twisted somehow my gut. Slightly, not to the point of going to, needing to go to the doctor, but I didn't think that I would be suitable to go to the Antarctic with this with this condition. This doctor was another very old man. Asked a few questions, very poor, informal, medical interview in my. Nothing like what I'd had at once or twice at the university medical team.
Right.
Anyway, you know, I then get a letter. It's not very long that after, you know, within a week or two, accepted, you know, please report to Ray Ady at Birmingham University at the earliest opportunity. Sorry, I can't. I'm writing my thesis. Eventually, Ady persuades me to will come by the 1st of November, I think. All this interviewing was done probably back in August, I would guess. So I then join three other geologists at Birmingham University had just been set up. Ray Ady had just been appointed. This was his first. The geologists who were already in the Antarctic had suddenly come under his jurisdiction, and they did not like it.
Why was that?
Interfering with their ability to do what they wanted themselves.
Oh, I see. So he was trying to direct their program.
Yes, that's right. Program director. That was part of his job, obviously. The four of us were his first candidates who he had complete control of. So he's a little bit disgusted with me, I would think, because of not wanting to join him immediately.
So you had to write your thesis in double quick time, did you?
Well, I've been working on it through the... it was planned to get it done by... there was trouble getting it typed in those days. Obviously, the thing had to be typed up properly. And it wasn't completed until the final date was the 1st of October. Well, 30th of September, I suppose. And I was given a couple of weeks' grace, something like that, had to be in. Otherwise, it would be 6 months delay. And it got in on time for that 1st of October. But then to have had the oral examination, which must have taken place in October as well. But I certainly got to AD to Birmingham and had about six or seven weeks there before the ship sailed.
Let's backtrack slightly, if we may. On reflection, do you think that the job was yours anyway, that your professor... Do you remember your professor's name?
Whittard. Right. Fred Whittard.
Do you think he had already swung it for you before you went for the interview?
I would think so.
Because it sounds very relaxed, doesn't it?
Yes, and it does indeed. I would have said he probably wrote me a, good, what do you call it?
Reference.
Well,
what did he make of Ray Ady as a person?
Well, at that time, we rather liked him. In fact, I always liked him, actually. I never fell out with him. A lot of people fell out with him one way or another. I didn't like the interference that there was with him. He was very... He was extremely good and had very high standard of writing reports and such like, presentation, which was a good thing from his point of view, but it upset a lot of other people. I think he could have possibly done rather better in some ways, and not brought some more guys who were disappointed with him could have got them working properly. Certainly one or two of my friends, I would say that. But personally, there was never any problem.
Had you had any desire to go south to the Antarctic before that point in your life?
So it wasn't
the Antarctic that attracted you, it was a job, was it?
It was a job, yeah. I was being taken on as a geologist, I was being paid £500-odd a year, and all found. And then, of course, at the back of my mind, I suppose, would be the fact that when I got back, I'd be over 26 and not liable to national service.
Was that a major factor? Was avoiding draft a major factor?
No, it wasn't a major factor.
But a nice convenience.
But it was convenient. And certainly other people, Prof, for instance, would certainly have thought it. That a lot of people, you must also bear in mind that within a year or so of my getting back, National Service had been abandoned anyway. So there were obviously a lot of people who were very fed up with it. Even the army itself didn't like it. So, but it was certainly a convenience to me. But I always thought, you know, that I was going to do National Service. Mm.
Now, the reason why I mentioned it, you're the first person I've interviewed who's mentioned it at all. I wasn't aware of it, that you could avoid National Service by joining FIDS.
You could avoid, oh yes. But it's one of the few ways that could be done. I don't know whether anybody else, a fair number of people, it must have affected some of the other people that were with me. I would have had the advantage of 3 extra years having done my PhD. But as I say, we're in the period. My geological colleagues, it wouldn't have, that they would have had to have done National Service. But of course, by the time they'd done their PhDs and so on, it had disappeared anyway. And within a year or two. So it's affecting only those, but particularly the 2 or 3 years, I would guess, when FIDS was recruiting more and more people. Up to about 1950, 51, 52, they didn't really recruit a lot of people. You would probably find a few other people who it affected in the way that I'm telling you, but not many.
Did you, a strange phrase, did you warm to the idea of going to the Antarctic? Or were you still dispassionate when you left?
Not particularly. I mean, as I say, the key thing was I had a job, and I had a geologist. I was going to be a geologist. I was going to be a working geologist. That was really the key thing to me. I was not interested in the slightest in the Scott sort of attitude of going to the Antarctic for the daring do of it. Not at all.
So how did they get on? First of all, how much preparation did they give you for that kind of, for that side of the job, if you like, the Antarctic?
We were the four of us. There were four of us up at Birmingham, and AD kept us very much under his wing. We never went to the London office. We did go to the Ordnance Survey office. We went to Cambridge Polar Research Institute one day, where AD himself had done his PhD and worked for several years, of course. He prepared us for going to the Antarctic, got us to read a number of books on the Antarctic, like Kevin Walton's, that sort of thing. He gave us mainly geological training, actually. And part of the last, I guess he was busy with his own work, because he sent us out doing geological mapping in the Lickey Hills for most of November. So
10 years later, they were still doing the same thing, you know.
Yes, I would guess so.
Lewis had the same
same sort of thing.
Project, yes. Mm. Lewis Duke.
One of the things he did do is he equipped us fairly well. We had this huge tin box which weighed a ton, full of various, you know, well, hammers and books and all sorts of things. Everything the geologist should need, short of a microscope. But, including things like cameras and so on, or a camera. Which was our personal gear. some of the bits and pieces around. That ruler there is from that. Few things left. He never gave us very much in the way of well, we did some survey training as well. But yes, it would be very much the same as what people did in the succeeding years. We would just happen to be the first.
Crevasse rescue, health and safety, any of that?
No.
Nothing?
Not that I don't remember anything, no. Mm. I don't think there could have been. He sent us to the dentist. I remember that. If it was any health, there might have been, but I certainly when I got down to the end, I was still absolutely green, yes.
Looking back on that again, do you think that was rather a dangerous scenario to send untrained men to the Antarctic wilderness?
Yes, of course it was. But we were just men, weren't we? Flying the flag, actually.
Oh, really? Do you think that's why you went?
Oh, yes.
Can you elaborate on that, Dennis?
Well, not really. There's not a lot of absolutely direct evidence for it, but the general gist of how things were done in the next in the time I was down there was such that this is really what one came to believe. Certainly, it was a time when there were possible troubles with the South Americans, for instance. The attitude of FIDS and Falkland Islands and so on, and the ship. It's an impression, really, rather than anything specific. But I mean, they were quite happy that people should do geology. But they were all quite happy if somebody didn't do any geology, because there were people who went down as geologists who virtually did no geology the whole year, which is fate in a way. But to some extent, it could probably have been avoided.
They didn't do it because they didn't want to, or they couldn't.
They couldn't because they were put, for instance, in a base where there was no geology to do, or right, where it was all done. People were, just unavoidably, I mean, to some extent, perhaps they had some choice. They could come back to, I think one fellow came back to UK, actually, and then went back down the following year. This sort of thing. Obviously, it's very, I think FIDS would have claimed that it was beyond their control, which, of course, largely it is. But there was a very big emphasis on the political side. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
So were you given any training for that then? Were you given arm-to-arm combat training? Or?
Oh, no, there was nothing. Yeah. No, it wasn't in that sort of
ballpark
at all, no.
So when did you sail, and what ship were you on?
We're on the John Biscoe. It was her maiden voyage. She was brand new. And I, amusing thing was, I put my suit in the wardrobe in the cabin, and a day or two later, took it out for some reason or other, and it got wet paint all over it, which hadn't dried because obviously it was in a confined space. But she was straight down from Glasgow, Dumbarton.
Brand new, or
absolutely brand new.
Not a conversion job.
No, it was a brand new ship. Replaced the first John Biscoe.
What did you make of her?
Oh, we were very pleased. I think everybody was pretty pleased all the way through. There was no. Had a one or two little spots of bother, perhaps with the engine or something, and we were supernumeraries. We were soon put down to painting the ship, which apparently needed painting, even though it was brand new. But that's in the way of things.
Was did she? She
this was late November.
55.
55. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Did she handle the sea?
No,
as well?
56. 50, late 56.
Late 56.
Mm.
Did she handle the sea as well?
Yes, and as well as I might have expected. I mean, a lot of people were very sick, but I just went off my food. There was a supply of cornflakes, milk, sugar, toast and marmalade, butter and marmalade, and more or less lived on that, actually, rather than trying to eat the ship's fare, which was typical ship's fare. You know, if you've been on the Irish passenger ferries, you would have got much the same. I don't think there was any complaint about that. She was a lot better sailor than the flipping Irish passenger ferry. I tell you that as well. I used to go Liverpool-Belfast steerage, and that was really to be seen to be believed, especially on the day after the Grand National. But,
so what was your journey? Did you call in at Montevideo on the way
down? We called in at Monte, yeah, we were in a hurry.
Why was that?
Oh, the Duke. The Duke was doing his round-the-world voyage in Britannia. Britannia was not suitable to go into the Antarctic, well, not very far into the Antarctic. Mm. And the John Biscoe was due to meet up with the Duke, scheduled for about New Year's Day, something like that, roughly. She had to be there.
At Stanley?
No, at Base W, actually. we spent only a day at Monte. Spent Christmas at Port Stanley. We're about three or four days there. We were kitted up, of course. But only only a very few days. And then we were off again, and the first stop was Anvers Island. I was put ashore with several of us in order... They had to get rid of the FIDs on board. So a whole lot of guys... I was due to go to Anvers Island as geologist, replacing Peter Hooper. The ship only it just got us off. It didn't unload any stores or anything like that. Within the hour, it had gone on. Presumably, it was late and to meet up with the Duke. Duke then and his group, party, courtiers or what have you, went on to the Biscoe. Some FIDs have been left on board, like my one of my colleagues, Nigel Proctor. I think all three geologists stayed on board, actually, because obviously they weren't. The Anvers Island base was only for six people, but there were about 15 or so of us there. But anyway, the other three geologists stayed on board, so they stayed with and had a good view of the Duke set up right the way through his visit up through the islands.
So what was it like with them? What was the overcrowding at Anvers like? Were you camping out on
tents? No, we were mostly up in the attic, actually.
Mm.
There was room to sort of bed down somewhere. The Duke appeared a few days after after I'd arrived. They'd spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time cleaning up the hut and the area around, getting rid of the filth around the base, etc., etc. The Duke arrived. We were under strict instructions that we were going to be as very, very green, obviously, be kept in very much in the background. We were allowed to shake hands with the Duke, but that was all. It was the others who gave him his sledge ride and took him up to the various bird breeding colonies. Anvers was a good place for that. Some guys came up at some point. This Duke had gone up the hill to presumably see something like the petrels or skuas or something like that. And guys came up with, you know, what was presumably then somebody had phoned him from Buckingham Palace, so they had to get off the ship, go ashore, and cart this fairly heavy gear up the hill to, so he could answer the flipping phone. Presumably the Queen might not have been. He was very relaxed. We didn't really need to have cleaned up the base. You know, he had a cup of tea or something in the base with the base leader. Peter Hooper would tell you all about that if you haven't interviewed him yet. You have, right. So I expect I'm just telling you a story about somebody who wasn't particularly involved, was kept very much in the background.
Well, let's move on then, because that's not fair. When did you find out you had to go to detail instead?
Well, virtually a day or two after that, Peter Hooper says, let's get to work. It was a beautiful summer, plenty of fine weather. We were using dinghies to get out to these little islands, and I was helping him do the geology. He'd done a fair bit through the winter, but I would guess not a lot. Most of his work was done by dinghy and in the summer. So I was helping with that. He then sent me out to the Jubin Islands, which is about a couple of hours in the Wynne Edwards launch out to the west. He left me there eventually. So I was working out there, again doing a fair bit of geology. So virtually, before Nigel Proctor, for instance, had even landed, I had done something like 2 or 3 weeks solid geology. Now, that's more than a lot of people ever did whilst they were in the Antarctic. Then news comes that I was to be transferred to Base W. I was out in the Jubin Islands. I said, I might as well carry on here whilst I can. There was no definite time. It was just that AD had said that I should transfer. So I carried on working about another week. So it was probably about the end of... I've got all the dates, but I can't remember them specifically. About the end of January, early February, I would guess, when captain, the John Biscoe, said, well, I want this fellow... He can't be out of the Jubin Islands. He must be at my ship. I'll be calling at such and such a time. So, and he actually comes in and takes his launch, the Biscoe's launch, comes and collects me. so obviously, you know, there was a bit of requirement from head office. He was under orders there, I would guess.
Do you know what the rationale was?
They wanted a geologist at Base W. It was fairly essential because it was a new base. It had only been opened the year before. Also, the geologist had suddenly resigned. Hedley Wright, who was due to stay there the following year. So this was a great stroke of luck for me.
Why did he resign, do you know?
No. there was trouble. There was trouble both with head office, with FIDS, that is. I don't know whether it's Port Stanley or probably Port Stanley, but also trouble on the base as well. You'd have to ask him why he resigned.
So you stepped into his shoes to pick up the work he was doing.
Doing, that's right, yes.
Why is doing geology in the Antarctic so important?
It's a new thing. What we were doing was a geological reconnaissance, exploring new territory. You know, when nothing has been known before, so everything is effectively new. And you might find we were under orders to look for mineral deposits, look for signs of
commercial ones. You mean?
Oh yes, oil, this sort of thing. This was all part of the thing, but most particularly, it's the basic geology, which you need to know, and that will eventually possibly lead to a possibility of economic deposits. You could say, you know, there is an academic science in itself. But most of all, geology is in the service of man, I would say.
Mm.
Not really much cop without that.
So what were you looking for particularly, Ian? What were your tasks?
Well, it was just reconnaissance geology, to look and see what the rocks were, study them as far as possible, collect samples for later study back in Birmingham.
So what were you finding at Detail?
Well, when we got to Detail, very much the same as the geology all the way down the peninsula is roughly rather similar. but as an area of sort of, I don't know, 100 square mile, 100 miles by 100 miles, something like that, probably a bit less than that, the detail of that was what was necessary. If you look at the geological map, you know, you've got a part which is effectively my work.
Were you finding anything which surprised you?
Oh yes, and there were lots of, well, in detail there were lots of, there's a lot of the rocks were igneous rocks, particularly various sorts of granites, and there was quite a lot of those which are still unique. In fact, I can't really understand why people haven't gone back and studied them further.
You mean you found rocks that hadn't been found anywhere else?
Oh yes. Mm-hmm. Other rocks were rather similar, but certainly there's one group of islands which it'd be well worthwhile going back to now. Particularly with modern equipment and so on, it's quite surprising. Nobody appears to have been back. In fact, the whole that side of geology is rather decline. But effectively, I've done a geological survey. You could do this. Well, people did in the 19th century. The geological survey of Great Britain, George Barrow. Did a survey of the area around between here and Whitby. Same basis, and published a memoir, published geological maps, which are available, which we still use. all we can do is just improve and amend them a bit. That applies. And other people like Robin Curtis's or Peter Hooper's reports stand as the geology of the Antarctic Peninsula.
Did you theorise about why the rocks there should be so different from anywhere else?
Oh yes, you know, it's part and parcel. I mean, that goes back to any studies of geology. It goes back to things like Scott's geologist,
High
Priestley.
What were your thoughts at the time?
well, that would be very, very complicated. But you know, we were up in the forefront of the science of geology, basically. There was a big argument going on at that time about the formation of granite-type rocks.
Granitization, is that?
There's a theory of granitization, yes. And there were a lot of people who regard themselves as granitizers at the one end, saying virtually that something could be made, you know, this table could be turned into granite. alchemy, almost. And there were other people who said that, no, it was formed as a magma, which was actually intruded into the country rocks. At that time, this argument was raging, and Peter Hooper appeared to be a granitizer. Now he tells me that he was just pulling my leg. AD was very much the other way. He was a downright magmatist. I'd been taught by my supervisor, Professor Coles Phillips, who was also at Bristol, that there was a sort of halfway, nearer to being a magmatist than a granitizer, but it was an intermediate position. And eventually Peter Hooper comes out with more or less that sort of position as well in his report, which at that, when we were at Anvers, of course, he was still working down there, and then he came back and did a couple of years research at Birmingham under AD. Well, AD certainly wouldn't have allowed him to publish a report which was granitizing. I'm sure it would have never got past him.
In a nutshell, granitization was what? It was the idea of...
There's the idea of turning an ordinary rock into a granite. With the aid, you had to add certain elements, like more aluminium, say, more silica. But essentially this could be done by dissemination of the element through the solid rock with heat and pressure and so on. And, you know, this has been proved to be something which may happen very deep down in the earth, but doesn't normally happen under most geological circumstances. Mostly magma's formed and is then wells up through the crust, and in case of a granite, it solidifies underground. In the case of the Iceland volcanic, it blows... comes out at the surface. You know, it's that's it. Put very, very, very simply.
Did you look for and find fossils?
No, but wouldn't expect to do so.
It was all volcanic material.
All volcanic or intrusive igneous rocks. There were certain parties down parts of Graham Land to the. You might like to just close the door.
Yeah. Don't worry.
People who were down, say, in Alexander Land or James Ross Island, for instance, rather different kettle of fish. They've actually got sedimentary rocks, they've got fossils to look at. Different style of geology, and what's the name of the guy? I've forgotten. It was with John Smith in Alexanderland a few years after me, but he made a very, very good job of studying the Jurassic succession in Alexanderland. Somehow seems to have fallen out with AD for some reason. I don't quite know why. Well, perhaps I've just forgotten.
Oh, well. Let's talk a bit about how it was down there. Obviously, a lot of the work was done in the field, so you were forming work parties to go out into the field, and you were sledging with dogs, I guess, at that time.
Oh, yes.
How was that for somebody who'd never climbed a mountain? How was that?
Well, the key thing about Base W, I mean, I arrived at Base W sometime in February, I suppose.
3rd of May?
No, it was earlier than that.
Earlier than that, okay.
Yeah. Wouldn't have been as late as May.
Sorry, 3rd of March?
March, yeah.
3rd of March.
March. The key thing was the base leader, Angus Erskine, a charismatic chap, lieutenant commander, already experienced, with some very good new ideas. The first really key idea he had, as far as I was concerned, was not to adopt the standard FIDS practice of having dog drivers and surveyors and geologists. What he said was the surveyors and geologists will be the dog drivers.
All right, yes.
That enabled the other members of the base, who were mostly meteorological assistants, to come out with the drivers and be able to do survey and geology. Otherwise, it would have been limited to the dog drivers and the surveyors and geologists. A small thing, but that made a heck of a difference to me, because I was going to be a dog driver. We arrived at Base W, all the stores, the usual thing, certain amount of time. Angus was very keen to get sledging straight away. The dogs hadn't been out for many months because W was prone to the sea ice going out. It's on a little island in the middle of a fjord, very, very liable to katabatic hurricanes. A small refuge hut was built about 10 miles on the mainland, about 10 miles to the east. Angus Shall I close the window a bit?
It doesn't matter, don't worry about it.
All right.
It's a bit to get a bit stuffy.
Where was I? He organised that this should be this autumn sledging party. Four of us, 21 dogs. We were very short of dogs. The previous year, there had been some pups, but for one reason or another, they were all bitches. Something like 8 or 9 bitches on the base. He'd brought some extra dogs down with him, dogs which other people didn't want, incidentally, so they were a poor lot, including some which they didn't want for one reason or other, particularly Bodger and Fluke, who'd been the trouble of Captain Anderson. At Hope Bay. he was going to train the dogs, do a bit of autumn sledging, get things started, and then when the sea ice formed, he'd go back to base, and we could then do quite a lot of survey from the base. That forced me into getting properly organised, and he provided the training, obviously. He's already trained, etc., etc. The fourth person was John Smith, who was a Met assistant, and he'd spent a previous year, I think, at Sydney. Jim Medell, the two surveyors, myself, with three teams proposed. Obviously, the Angus and Jim Medell were going to have the two dog teams. I was left with the girls.
What was your team called?
The Girls.
The Girls. Oh, nice. Right. Did you take to it?
Oh yes, they served me extremely well. I mean, they had their foibles. They were only a very light team, of course, but we were only operating in. We were never really very far from base, we're not, you know, and we weren't doing this sort of Scott AD type, Fuchs type activities. You see, or at least I wasn't. Some of the others wanted to do that. But anyway, you know, we got the three teams more or less trained up in that period, had our ups and downs. That Angus wanted the people the year before had managed to get up onto the plateau up the Murphy Glacier. We emulated them, pile of food and dog and the sledge rations up onto the plateau. Angus and Jim Medell then made a journey down to Base Y, left us to do a bit of geology and get back to the refuge hut, which we eventually did. Then waited for the sea ice to form, which it did eventually, and got ourselves back to base.
Well, Detail had a reputation for having unreliable sea ice,
It was extremely unreliable.
Tended to hamper the working parties. So was that a constant problem?
Yes, it was no. it had been a problem the year before. We had to wait quite a long time at this refuge to get back. The sea ice did then form. I then went out for a couple of weeks or so with John Thorne to Hennussy Bay. I never kept very good records of what anybody else did or what happened at base. So my own record is always usually just me and one other person. Mm. We then came back. John Thorne taught me an awful lot as well, in particular about how to maintain equipment, which Angus wasn't quite so good at. I then went out on a sledging trip up to Darvel Bay for again 2 or 3 weeks. We probably had about a month's rations on the sledge, I would think, which is about what the girls were capable of. By that time, we had 9 girls rather than 7. This was with Ozzie Connacky, who was the radio operator going out sledging. unheard of. Mm. This was Angus's big idea, but the dog driver was there to take him.
Who operated the radio whilst he was out in the field?
Oh, that was a difficulty. It became a huge difficulty. Well, the others could operate the radio, but they got a lot of help from Base Y, from what I gather, and restricted things, you know, sort of minimised things. Obviously wouldn't have done anything like the amount of radio traffic that Aussie had done. Anyway, we went out, we got up to the Darvel Islands. At some point I discovered that he was filming. he was making a cine film of me. You see? Unfortunately, the Darvel Islands weren't into thin ice, and the whole back of the sledge collapsed into the water. lost his cine equipment, which was on the back. Of course, you know, all camera equipment was usually hoisted on the back of the on the handlebars. Then went on round doing a bit more geology. Started back to Lallaman to Base W. Got round in onto the corner of Cape Ray at Lallaman, of
between Double Bay and Lallaman Fjord, came up against a crack lead, about 4 or 5 feet wide, I suppose, easily bridgeable by the sledge, get the dogs to jump over it. Didn't like that. It was getting late in the afternoon, go back a couple of miles, camp, set up our camp, wake up in the middle of the night and I'm all wet because I've gone through the sea ice with my heat of my body. but anyway, not to bother about that. Get up, pack up, go back to the lead. It's now probably about 20 or 30 yards wide. No chance. And rapidly disappearing into the distance. So we get then. I think we got up onto an iceberg, something like that. Get a better view. Found there was open water out beyond Cape Ray, and into Lallaman Fjord. No chance. So go back to Darbal Islands. Darbal Islands. The ship had put a cache of stores there. Which we could live off with help from killing seals. Incidentally, he had no gun or anything. There's an easy way of killing a seal. Bop it on its nose with a geological hammer. Anybody ever told you that? Much, much, much more a better way than shooting the poor thing.
More efficient.
More efficient. They just collapse, you know, they put a knife in and then, you know, it's there. But a lot of animals, you know, that's an easy way to kill them. Not that I'd do it now. Thought, you know, it's amazing what you did then. I don't think anybody, people like to shoot. There were guys on base who really wanted to spend time using up the 303 ammunition. Anyway... we ensconced ourselves on the Double Islands. We then made an effort to go north to Base J. Again came up with open water quite close to Base J. It was only a few miles away, but there's no chance. So we retired to the Double Islands, still doing some geology. might as well collect the samples whilst we're about it. See what was what, and lie out for the ship to come, which could be we hoped within 2 or 3 months. In fact, you know, because of one thing or another, it was delayed more than that. Anyway, lying down, lying up in camp, every now and again, we were in the midst of a daily penguin colony as well, so there was quite a lot of noise, and of course the dogs were there, kicking up a fuss every now and again if a penguin got anywhere near them. Terrific row going on. There was Angus and John Thorne, and they had made this what I think is an amazing journey up from the refuge hut up to the up the Murphy Glacier onto the plateau, northwards along the plateau, down a glacier, down into Darbal Bay.
They were looking for you.
Coming to for us, yes. you know, to look, well, looking for us. They were expecting to find us Angus expected to find us actually on the mainland, very close to the Darbal Islands, which I suppose in retrospect I could have done. I could also have bear in mind that as a dog driver, I was totally in charge of that, you know, subgroup. no, incidentally, we didn't have a radio with us. There was a shortage of, I think there were only two, radios for the two surveyors, sledge radios. So I never went out with a radio that year. But anyway, they were looking for us. Yes, not having found us at the bottom of the glacier, they came out to the obvious next spot,
the depot.
Depot at the Darbal Islands, found us, and we, you know, obviously packed up straight away, got us going, and we all sledged back the same way round to the refuge hut, open water, of course, no chance really of getting back to base until the ship came. So I was actually out 5 months then. We eventually got back. The ship didn't come because it couldn't get through the heavy pack.
So the four of you were off base for that length of time?
Yes. We part of the time we were doing Angus's film. Have you seen the film? Probably. The few years ago now, Bass published a DVD with parts of it is to do with the conserving the area and taking all the equipment, removing everything, all the waste, and dismantling Base J in particular. But the fourth part is Angus's dog. He was very intent on making this film of teaching people how to drive dogs in the FID style. So Ozzie Connacky, John Thorne and myself, he was taking the film, obviously. The other three of us are the, stars. The dogs are the stars.
Talking of films, let's take an intermission now and come back and do some more shortly.
Okay.